so that everyone can share the outcomes of this webinar. A short poll should be activated at the end of the webinar, so please answer it. It's very important for us. And before we start, I will just present in a few words XAPA. Adrien, so if you could please share this presentation, that would be super great. My name is Raphaël Hara, and I'm Managing Director of XAPA. In a few words, XAPA is a mission-driven organization. We are very committed to our impact targets, and we do that by organizing several activities. The first one is sustainability consulting. We specialize in business and human rights and impact finance, and more generally on sustainability. And we have also designed some innovative supply chain solutions that I will present in just a moment. We have a quite extensive experience within the team on various commodities. We have gathered various expertise on agronomy, development, project engineering, digital, and finance. And we are very much committed to advocacy as well as a mission-driven organization. So here are a few examples of what we produce on our website, ksapa.org, ksapa.org, on sustainability, impact investing, climate, inclusive growth, and human rights. So we have reports, briefing papers, articles, webinars. Especially if you are interested in VCMs, we have organized already two webinars on the topic. One with the Asian Development Bank, with which we work to organize a study on how to drive policy decisions to foster VCM use for smallholders in India, and also how to use digital solutions at ICT for Ag. So next slide, please. Yeah, so this is the example. We have quite extensive footprint. In color is the countries in which we have collectively worked as XAPA members. And you can see here our offices in Paris, London, and New York, and our values in Réunion Island as well. And circles representing our various impact programs for agricultural supply chains, namely several in Indonesia, Sri Lanka, Philippines, and recently Ivory Coast, with a partnership with Société Générale to foster inclusive finance. So as I was saying, we have developed quite innovative solutions for supply chain. At the first mile level, what we want is to target smallholders who do not have access to basic infrastructures such as professional training, digital access to finance, or access to market. There are many challenges, and we try to address with our own means part of these gaps through an initiative and a solution called SUTI, which is organized threefold. First, technical assistance and program design and management. Second, low-tech digital solutions that we have designed to be farmer-centric, working on all kind of phones offline, and which are also illiterate-friendly and unable to collect data from the smallholders, but also disseminate content, training content, and information to the smallholders. And the third is the use of innovative impact finance to implement those programs, either through inclusive finance, blended finance, or VCMs, and that's the topic today. A little zoom on our SUTI digital suite, which enables us to interact with smallholders even in very difficult environment with low connectivity, poor equipment, and let's say very low literacy or digital literacy. So we have organized this suite with a back office for local instructors, a participant app for smallholders, which is mobile-based, multilingual, and very versatile to be able to perform in those very difficult environments, and reporting dashboard for the sponsors. All of this in different programs, in various programs that we do. We organize with thousands of farms per program in order to foster capacity building, access to digital, social inclusion, and increase in diversification of revenues in addition to climate action. So our first purpose is to foster social inequality fights. And we use for that all levers that we can find to improve smallholders' revenues, yield increase, diversification of income, circular economy, carbon valuation. And yeah, that's the way we deliver on the SDGs by trying to reach the first mile with a multi-dimensional impact approach. We do that also by developing many projects in the voluntary carbon market space with our various partners, namely in Sri Lanka, in India, in the Philippines as well, on value chains such as coconut, such as rice and rubber production. So our approach brings, let's say, the use of change of practices that we assess are necessary to increase the livelihoods of the smallholders. And since we have designed these digital tools enabling to collect, monitor programs and collect data on a large scale with a quite competitive cost in a hybrid mode with our local NGO partners, we can help transform existing farms and answer to the increasing demand of VCMs, including fostering change of practices in existing farms. So that's how we target this multidimensional impact in these various countries that I mentioned and the various commodities chain I mentioned. So we here show a map showing our various program under development in the VCM space with different kinds of different stages of maturity. And our target is really to reach for each of these programs thousands of farmers with a multidimensional impact and innovation on the way to produce their existing commodities. Thank you. So in a few words, to introduce the topic and before leaving my colleague Adrien give more details. VCMs, voluntary carbon markets. We are not talking here about regulatory carbon markets, but only voluntary carbon markets. I have been under massive controversies. There are some in-depth or fundamental controversies and criticisms. Is it possible? Is it ethical to offset? Is it ethical to offset not in our own value chains? Is it also ethical to launch programs in the global south to help, advanced economies to continue their activities? There are also some criticisms on the form of carbon projects with programs of integrity of carbon credits. We will come to that. Human rights attempt. But in the same time, climate action it is. And there are not so many projects which are, so many fields or so many solutions which are that active in the climate action space. And VCMs are one of them. So now I will leave it to my colleague Adrien that will go through a bit deeper this VCMs and how to ensure environmentally and socially impactful voluntary carbon markets.
Thanks, Raphael. So as Raphael mentioned, and I think everyone is aware in this webinar, VCM have been growing strongly over the past decades and have been emerging as one of the most interesting instruments to drive multiple transitions that are much needed, whether it is energy or agricultural transition. We see many companies setting science-based targets, signaling willingness to design climate strategies, which greatly impacts the demand. Some estimates a 15-fold increase in demands by 2030, with, of course, a potential great impact on the price that would enable to finance those transformative projects. At the same time, what we see is that VCM might be an interesting instrument and a new market. still some controversies have emerged recently, which are putting in question the fundamentals of the market. Most controversies are targeting two focus of VCM. The first one is the environmental impact, which is questioned. I'm sure most of you have heard of the Guardian article that was questioning the baseline of some conservation REDD+ projects in South America. And at the same time, human rights are infringed in quite large projects. For example, eviction of indigenous communities in Kenya, or land grabbing, as Rafael mentioned. What is interesting to note is that those concerns are all carbon projects, whether it is renewable energy in China or AFOLU projects, AFOLU standing for agricultural land use projects in Africa or South America. Not all carbon projects can be deemed high quality in terms of their environmental and social impacts. So considering that VCM are nascent markets, it's interesting and, of course, needed to have this kind of constructive criticism being brought into the open. I think most standards remain open to the criticism and are taking that into account to improve their current practices. And that's also the purpose of this webinar today, to reflect on the criticism and how we can improve current methodologies. The first step in this discussion is reframing the role of VCM in climate change mitigation strategies. As I mentioned before, a lot of corporates are now setting science-based targets. I'm sure most of you are aware of the Science-Based Targets Initiative. We've seen increasingly growing companies that set those targets, 80% increase in 2022 compared to the year before. However, that doesn't mean that those companies have a good understanding of how to use VCM. Here we showcase a simple tool called mitigation hierarchy, which basically guides the prioritization of action to achieve those targets. And as you can see on the figure on the right, offsetting is the last resource. First, avoidance of emission at all costs, reducing what we're already emitting. And last is really offsetting. That's really key, and that has been also emphasized by IPCC in their recent reports. Offsetting is quite new and has been introduced in Kyoto Protocol in 1997. First and foremost, as a cooperation mechanism between northern and southern countries to fight against climate change. But what is really important to keep in mind is that emissions reduction will always be more important and should come first compared to emissions removal. Once we have that in mind, and if we focus on environmental integrity, a lot of the actors within the ecosystem have tried to establish some principles to align on the what makes a good quality carbon credit in terms of environmental impacts. Three dimensions are usually used to assess this integrity. Emissions should be verified, additional in the sense that without the project, they would not have happened, and permanent. Permanence meaning that the emissions that we sequester should be sequestered for a long period of time. There's a threshold of 100 years that is usually taken as a reference in the scientific community. However, from those principles being translated into projects and operationally used by standards and project developers, arise some divergences. With the same project activities, different methodologies can rule the quantification of emissions and divergence in the quantification of impacts arise. Some task force have emerged to try to standardize those integrity principle. Among them, the task force on scaling voluntary carbon markets from Mark Carney should be noted. It's also interesting to note that until now, most of the integrity debate has been focused on GHG integrity only, and not taking into account other environmental or social aspects. And that's what is currently lacking in VCM framework, in the sense that ESG risk management is not fully applied to evaluation of carbon projects. Right now, climate integrity is really narrow focused, only focusing on GHG impact of the project, which induces a blind spot, with regards to other ESG risk. For example, social and human rights respect are not integral parts of the assessment of carbon projects from most standards. At the same time, positive and environmental and social impacts should be incentivized and put forward by the ecosystem. VCM should go beyond do no harm stance, in the sense that having no net harm is good, but what we're reaching for is positive environmental and social impacts. That's especially important in trying to extend the legitimacy of VCM in host countries, to be able to anchor those projects on the long term among local communities. Positive impact is key. A good example of that is the new standards developed by Vera for climate, community, and biodiversity standards, which rewards projects that have a holistic approach. At the same time, GRI standards has an interesting approach by pushing project developers to inherently target two additional SDGs on top of the climate action. This incentivizes and rewards holistic projects which have dimensional impacts. However, having a social action is costly. Whether you talk about agricultural projects that involve smallholders or multidimensional projects that aim at contributing to several SDGs, this induces additional costs, which of course hinders project developers in bringing their projects to markets and to investors. What is interesting to note, and I think Carla will come back on that, is that in recent years, there's been a stream of new instruments that have emerged in trying to incentivize impacts on the one hand, and we can with the impacts linked finance space, and on the other hand, blended finance, which mixes private and public capital to try and decrease risk. Those instruments combined with VCM make it really interesting and impactful for project developers, and make projects that are impactful but riskier more bankable for investors. One interesting case study is a project backed by the Atelier Fund, which is now part of Mirova Asset Management. So the fund was backed by US real estate guarantee, which basically allowed Atelier to provide a below market rate loan to an NGO that conducted some conservation activities with farmers. This NGO secured the repayments of the loan thanks to carbon credits that were generated through the REDD+ projects. And here we see a good example of how by combining those new instruments, so not only relying on voluntary carbon markets, but additional financial innovation, can improve the bankability of such multidimensional projects that we need, but are, as of today, deemed too risky for most investors. I end my presentation with the slide presenting a tentative methodological approach that we have developed at XAPA. The rationale being that everyone agrees on recognizing that while VCMs offer good opportunities, there's many drawbacks that we need to fix. However, it's a bit too early for some to propose an approach and a good approach to developing projects. So here we are trying to propose an approach. We've discussed up to now of climate integrity. That's ground zero and really the first step to any impactful carbon projects. What we think makes impactful projects key is the analysis of the social and environmental context. What are the risk needs and opportunities of the local communities? A common risk, for example, is the lack of formalization of land tenure. Most projects do not think about supporting smallholders in obtaining and formalizing those land rights, and that should not be the case. Similarly, for needs, biodiversity is usually largely absent of VCM projects, while it can provide an additional revenue stream for smaller farmers. As such, we've seen now quite a few projects, and we're setting up one that includes, for example, beehives in agricultural activities. As I was mentioning, involvement and onboarding of local communities is really key, not only in terms of respecting human rights, but a transparent and fair process between project developers and the farmers must be established from the get-go. This is the only possible foundation for long-term partnership between external investors, project developers, and local communities. This is also the that will kickstart a project design phase towards regeneration. The idea being that projects should target multidimensional impacts. It should be regenerative in the sense that for communities, there is not only the value created by carbon credits, which should be divided fairly, but trying to activate all sources of revenues possible. No burning of rice straws in AWD project, for example, could give rise to an additional valuation of those byproducts, which provide an additional revenue stream for communities. Holistic thinking and approach is really needed. And I think one principle that we're quite attached to at XAPA is really targeting not just financial impact, financial value, but impacts. The practices should provide inherent impact to the communities on top and above financial value from the credits. Aligning on the standard methodology gives way for valuation of those multidimensional impacts. And that's the basis for building a multi-stakeholder coalition that can adopt a landscape approach, meaning that we should not only use and focus on carbon within territories, but try to address additional issues such as inclusive financing for local communities. And with that, I'll hand over to Raphael.
Thank you, Adrien. Well, it was very interesting. I had plenty of questions, but it lasted a bit longer than we thought. So I'll pass directly to the following guest speaker, and we have Hugues Sobre from Gold Standard Foundation and Carla Orrego from Climate Policy Initiative. Ladies first, Carla. Hi, welcome to this webinar, and thanks for taking the time.
Hi, Rafael, and good morning to everyone. Thanks to XAPA for the invitation today. My name is Carlos Rego, and I'm CPI's Innovative Finance Manager. So very quickly, for those not familiar with CPI, maybe if you can go to the next slide. We are an advisory and analytical organization working on the intersection of climate, policy, and finance, for unlocking capital for climate action. We work with governments, businesses, and financial institutions to drive economic growth while addressing climate change. So if you go to the next slide, please. We are focused on the climate challenge from an investment perspective. As you can see in the graph, the climate finance gap is increasing exponentially. And despite climate finance flows surpass the 1 trillion mark for the first time in 2022, we still need close to a tenfold increase to meet the climate objectives set for 2030. Investment levels are far behind what is needed for a successful low carbon transition, and these amounts are beyond what is available in the public and philanthropic sectors. So there is an urgent need for private capital to help bridge this gap. And one of the key limiting factors limiting these climate investments is the lack of investable solutions. So if you go to our next slide, please. Yeah, so CPI has over a decade of experience in climate finance effectiveness and tracking and in working to develop bankable solutions to address investment pipeline risks, especially in developing countries. We manage two accelerator programs that address market barriers to develop and scale innovative climate instruments and that can help mobilize private capital. Many of these instruments that we structure rely on carbon markets and use some form of carbon finance into their core design to help tackle different climate challenges. So as you can see in the slide, the first of these programs is the Global Innovation Lab for Climate Finance. This is an incubator that designs and develops financial structures that can be launched into the market. And then we have the Catalytic Climate Finance Facility, which is meant to be the continuation of the lab and is more like an accelerator that supports the market rollout of these financial structures towards scalability, providing seed capital and customized strategic support. The lab has a portfolio of 68 financial vehicles that have collectively mobilized over $4 billion in sustainable investments in 9 years of operations. And we just launched the CC facility last year and announced our first cohort in Dubai at COP28 this last December. So thanks, Rafael. Over to you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Carla. We have a few questions for you. And especially, well, as you said, CPI had quite some experience and extensive experience on VCMs. So could you share some lessons learned or recommendations to design efficient in terms of carbon and GHG emissions avoidance action, but also in terms of social and environmental action more broadly? What are your recommendations for that? And especially, what place do you see globally for VCMs in climate finance and climate action?
Sure. So before jumping right into it, I want to highlight two things about our general approach around carbon markets. The first is that we see carbon offsets playing an important transition role in neutralizing emissions, while also serving as an important funding mechanism to protect natural capital. But that said, voluntary offsets should not be the leading tactic for zeroing out emissions, especially in the private sector, and an emphasis must be placed on reducing the emissions as much as possible. And the second point is that VCMs are essential in route to reaching true zero, so efforts should be placed in scaling the market. And rather than criticizing their potential for abuse or different focus on true abatement, we need to support the process of building integrity across the entire voluntary carbon market supply and use chain. And that means supply side, demand side, intermediaries, and from offset creation to aggregation to trading and retirement. So now moving into the lessons learned, I want to share some insights and key takeaways for impactful VCMs. First, on the demand side, we are seeing an exponential growth in VCMs, mostly driven by private entities starting to operationalize their net zero pledges. So it is important to build a robust plan B for trading to scale and ensure demand integrity. Another point is that we have seen is that corporates are struggling to identify projects to invest in. So many companies are now focused on using philanthropic capital to create an investable pipeline of carbon projects that produce high quality credits. In the case of smaller companies where capital is more limited or not as available, we're seeing innovations in offtake contracting and this approach becoming very promising. So for example, distributing the pre-feasibility cost, which is the riskiest stage of the carbon project, with the right to purchase equity in the project at a discounted rate. On another side, as also I think Edwin mentioned, demand for high quality credit is going to keep increasing now that we have better standardization in the market and that corporations are looking to achieve net zero targets validated by science. So since the SBTi sets limitations on the amount of carbon credits that can be used to achieve science-based targets, and also corporations realizing emissions reductions may take longer than 2030, we anticipate a significant price increase in the credits. One final comment on this point is that we should be open to the idea that not all emissions abatement actions need to be treated equally, meaning that we need to account for the relative difficulty or ease of abatement in any given sector. For example, the pricing or availability of offsets could be flexible depending on the level of difficulty of abatement. And this could provide an incentive to abate more and use less offsets over time. So that on the demand side. Now moving into the supply side, there is no news that there is a supply shortage, so we should expand the quantity and diversity of the credits. Demand is accelerating geometrically, but there is no organized effort to supply this need at a scale with acceptable quality. So we need to collaborate to accelerate the development of carbon projects, but we also need to encourage and support approaches to creating new types of credible offsets. So for the market to scale, we think we must significantly expand the variety of offsets that are usable to meet net zero commitments. And that not only includes expanding the types of removal credits, which include nature resolutions and carbon sequestration technology, but also expanding the use of avoided emissions credits in areas like avoided deforestation, active methane management, and power coal retirement. So that's one of the main points. And another point in the supply side is that we also need to adjust the speed for project development and delivered volumes. Currently, we have exceptionally long lead times between the initial investment and the eventual sale of offsets, and a small ticket size also detriments the liquidity and efficiency of the markets. So there is an important role here for financial mechanisms that aggregate offsets at market level volumes and in such a way that fairly compensates along the value chain. So in other words, we refer to this as a fair trade approach for offsets that ensures the sufficient value ultimately ends up with the originators of the offsets, whether they be cocoa farmers in Africa or indigenous communities helping to protect forests in the Amazon. One additional aspect here is that it's important to ensure supply side integrity as well as demand side integrity for the entire system to work. And as such, MRV systems are a key part of producing verified responsible credits. In particular, digital MRV could become a critical tool to scale projects as they help address concerns around additionality and permanence. And likely, registrars have finally created methodologies that will enable the adoption of these technologies. And finally, another recommendation from lessons that we have seen is that there should be an expansion of the geographic reach of market participants. For instance, most of the current supply of nature-based sequestration is concentrated in a small number of countries. So efforts to better incorporate carbon offsets into NDC plans and biodiversity protection initiatives should be pursued in many regions where they are underutilized, especially in developing countries. So yeah,
thanks.
There's a lot there, but yeah, hopefully like it helps summarize like some things we see on the demand side and other things in the supply side.
Yeah, thank you, Carla. Just another question briefly. So you've been active in the past decade. Could you share two examples of two promising climate finance instruments that have been impactful in using the VCMs? And also Another thing is in what you explained on the fact that maybe we should adapt emissions quota or issuance quota for depending on the difficulty or the needs of a particular sector. So do you feel that regulatory and voluntary carbon markets should converge at a certain time?
Okay, I'm going to address the first question first. So as I mentioned before, our aim is to create a pipeline of investable solutions, and we do so through financial innovation to de-risk transactions and drive investments towards the sectors and regions where capital is not going. And in that sense, our structuring approach is focused on breaking down barriers to investments by dealing with different financial risks that are involved in making a project bankable. With this in mind, several of the instruments in our portfolio leverage carbon markets, and as I mentioned before, use some form of carbon finance either as a core component or as an ancillary component. The first means that since inception, the instrument has considered an element to or related to carbon offset generation in its design, either as a revenue source or as a risk mitigator. And the second refers more to an effort to look for efficiencies in operations and include the carbon credit generation to improve the business models. One more thing is that it's worth noting that none of these represent the main revenue stream for the instrument, but an important secondary stream towards achieving commercial sustainability. So jumping now into the examples, the first case I want to share is the Lendable Decarbonization Fund. This is a $250 million debt fund addressing the lack of access to sustainability-linked financing for SMEs in developing countries. What set this apart from other typical debt funds is that it brings down the transaction costs to deploy sustainability-linked loans through digital MRV on top or working along a carbon project preparation facility that provides technical assistance and funding support for new carbon offset projects. And the target audience or the client base of this instrument is composed of a two-sided market with direct users on one side aiming to decarbonize their operations and enablers on the other side selling products or services that help others decarbonize. So essentially, this instrument is proposing to secure its loans by carbon-generating projects. Another case we're highlighting that is a bit different is the Fund for Nature. And this is a 100 million blended finance debt fund for nature-based carbon projects. It aims to increase the supply to meet the growing demand from corporate off-takers while increasing the economic benefit to project implementers and local communities. And here, a blended finance structure brings in mission-aligned private capital, allowing the fund to aggregate a portfolio of high-integrity projects and offer commercial returns to investors. And here, they are dealing with the size of the projects and generating high-integrity credits as well. The fund provides a market-rate debt to projects backed by long-term and standardized off-take agreements. And this structure allows projects to achieve better terms from carbon credit buyers, including a higher price for carbon. So yeah, those are like the two main examples I would like to highlight.
Thanks a lot, Carla. I think maybe I thought that my question on regulatory and voluntary carbon markets convergence could be much more interesting in the Q&A session. So please forgive me and withdraw it to reinsert this idea later on. Thanks a lot for this very interesting explanations. We will now move on to Hugh Solway from Gold Standard Foundation. Hi, Hugh. Welcome and thanks for your time again.
Hi, thank you very much. It's really nice to be here, and thank you to you for inviting Gold Standard to speak at this webinar. So my name is Hugh Solway. I'm the Senior Director for Market Development and Partnerships at Gold Standard, which is a non-profit certification standard based in Geneva in Switzerland. And if we move on to the next slide, I can just say a little bit more about Gold Standard before we get going. So Gold Standard has existed for over 20 years now. We were set up in 2003. We were founded by a group of international NGOs led by WWF, and WWF remain an important supporter and partner of Gold Standard, remain on our board as a representative there. And over the time that Gold Standard has been running, we through our standard, have been able to support over 3,000 projects at different stages to either implement impact or prepare to implement impact towards climate action and sustainable development. These projects are based across 100 countries globally and counting month by month. And they've been able to achieve significant impact, both to reduce emissions, but also to deliver shared value through wider sustainable development benefits as well. And I'll hand back to you at this point, if that's okay, for any questions before we go on to anything else.
Sorry.
I'll hand back to you for any questions, if that's okay, before I go on to the. I was going to use these for. Okay. I'll leave it there. I'll leave it there. I won't use the slides, which are up. Thank you.
Okay. So thanks a lot for the presentation. A few questions we have. So especially carbon standards have been heavily criticized in the past years and in the past months. So there were some TV shows, some articles, some various criticisms. It has been especially the case on the question of accuracy of measurements that serve as a basis, called baselines, to generate credits. What is gold standard position? What changes in the protocol or reinforcement of the protocol have you put in place? And maybe to go a bit further, what are the policies you have implemented to ensure that the benefits are not only linked to carbon, but also to more generally to SDGs?
So it's a really interesting question for this for gold standard, this one, because when we were set up in 2003, it was by WWF and others because of a concern about the way that the CDM, the Clean Development Mechanism, had been designed. And so gold standard, when it originally was established, was a label on top of the CDM. And so you could have a CDM project, but it also was labeled by gold standard to recognize the fact that it met other requirements around stakeholder inclusivity, around sustainable development, and other elements as well. And so built into gold standard is an understanding that the market is imperfect. And so we don't come to this question from a place of defending everything in the market. We come to it from a place of trying to set up a standard which delivers impact with integrity, both in climate mitigation but also in sustainable development. And that's what we always try to do within our standard. And we try in our standard always to reflect the latest science as well. And you can see this in the way that our standard evolves over time. The standard which we have now is very different to the one which we started in 2003. Some of the methodologies that we've had in place for a long time are very different now because our understanding of how to deliver impact has improved over time. The latest science, the data parameters that we refer to kind of externally have improved over time as science has improved there. And our standard is updated with that. And so this is kind of one of the main reflections which I give back on some of the criticism that we see that as a standard, we're trying to do something which is quite complicated to verify, certify impact in areas of the economy where governments haven't moved so far. And so they're sometimes often complicated. And we will always try to make sure that our standard reflects the best understanding of how to do that at the time. There's been several decisions that we've made in the past, which are kind of actively working against. If we were a private organization, you would never make these decisions, but it's there to kind of try to protect integrity. So we don't, for instance, certify REDD+ projects because of concerns that we had around 10 years ago about whether we could do that accurately, whether we could accurately certify impact and issue credits, given some of the baseline challenges for REDD as a sector. We initiated a grievance process into ourselves a few years ago where we recognized overcrediting under one of our methodologies, which led to a correction to the methodology. And then we went into the market to cancel credits, which represented the overcrediting. And so there's a lot of steps that we take as a standard to make sure that we reflect the highest levels of integrity in what we do. And we always maintain and stay up to date with the latest science which exists out there. That's answered the question about kind of climate mitigation. When we saw earlier the kind of 7 steps for developing a kind of high impact project. I can't remember exactly what it was called. That really reflected what we try to enable our projects to do through Gold Standard as well. One of the core things to know about Gold Standard for anyone who doesn't is, as we heard earlier, our standard isn't just there for climate mitigation. Every project must deliver direct and intended impacts in at least two other areas. So we're not talking about kind of indirect accidents. We're talking about areas where a project has a plan from the start that it will achieve additional health impacts through the intervention which it provides. It will achieve growth in jobs. It will lead to gender equality or other impacts. And these are measured, monitored, and certified over time. And that sustainable development impact is part of every single Gold Standard project. This isn't a label on top. This is integrated into the way our standard works. And also core to the way our standard works is making sure that projects aren't leading to negative harm. So we have strong safeguarding principles which are in place and requirements. Projects must have safeguarding plans which are looked at over time. And projects must also involve stakeholders from the start. So we have a kind of clear stakeholder inclusivity process, which must be kind of start from a stakeholder consultation right at the beginning, but must remain open through the project cycle as well, so that if there are any concerns, they can be raised and they can be addressed. And this is really important for the sustainability of projects. A good project isn't a project which just delivers climate impact. It's a project which delivers sustainable development benefits, but also works with local communities and has their buy-in from the very start. And that's clear in the success of some of the projects that we have had under our standard, which have taken this approach. And looking at some of the questions which have come through, it's also clearly recognized amongst buyers as well. You do see a premium for gold standards credits over those from other standards. And that's because in many cases of the fact that you have these additional safeguards, you have sustainable development benefits, which are built into the standard itself. So I'll stop there.
Yeah, maybe also to link with the questions we have in the chat and slightly enter into the Q&A session with that question. Do you see that also among samples of gold standard projects, like this project bringing the most impactful approaches in terms of social and environmental benefits, can be better, more attractive, let's say, to carbon buyers than more standard projects, even within your own standard?
Yeah, so I think that's the case. And it's a question that we always ask ourselves. So a few years ago, it seemed that there was more of a move towards trading of credits on exchanges. And we saw new contracts which were coming into play in the market. So kind of general contracts for credits from that were eligible under CORSIA or nature-based credits. And that's kind of clearly what you always see when a market scales. But it also doesn't help the projects which do go the extra mile and deliver extra impact to be kind of bundled in with a generic price. And that's something which we're always trying to think about. How do you make sure that projects are able to bring out the differentiation that they have? And one of the things that we're doing at the moment is we're about to kind of fully launch a new digital SDG tool, which allows projects to input data on their SDG impacts, but also to get visualizations coming out of that so that they can help to clearly visualize the impact that they're having, and so that can be there for buyers to look at as well. So there are things that we do there.
Okay, thanks a lot, Hugh. Entering in the Q&A, we can kind of got some very interesting questions. And the first one, maybe I would focus on Carla and for that one, is a question on let's say legitimacy of GCMs. I know that we've mentioned it in other words at the beginning of this webinar, but what's your take on that? Is the principle of us setting legitimate from your point of view, and in, let's say, to which conditions it will be?
Sorry, the question is if we see that VCMs are legitimate or are becoming legitimate?
Yeah, and to which conditions?
Yeah, definitely. As I mentioned, they are an important tool that we need to reduce emissions and to get to our net zero targets. But some refinements need to be done so we can scale the market more quickly. So as I was pointing out at the beginning, we need to expand the quantity, the diversity, and the speed in which projects on the ground are developed. And putting on top some additional features that will help the development and also improve the integrity of these projects. Like, for example, working with local communities and making sure that the originators or the creators on the ground receive the benefits. Applying new technologies along the work this been doing on the ground to scale this type of projects. So yeah, and what we're seeing is that the trend going up significantly. So maybe like the main issue is to try to match supply with demand right now, but we need carbon markets as a tool to our race towards net zero and address climate change.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Carla. Another question that was several times in the chat was linked to the question of this premium that you already mentioned, Hugh. And especially, okay, we understand that from now on, well, at this stage, there's a premium in the demand side, let's say from carbon buyers. Is it also the case on the investor side, from your point of view, meaning when investors fund carbon projects, are they likely to invest more budget, more money, if they can reach this multidimensional impact with probably a hope that it can be sold at a higher price as well?
Sorry, is this for me, this question, or?
Yeah,
sorry. Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think the answer is yes. And I think so there was a reference earlier in the chat to the report from Ecosystem Marketplace a few years ago. And I think we are seeing a growing kind of expectation that projects won't just deliver climate benefit, they will have wider impacts as well. One thing which is really interesting for us, and we're thinking about a lot at the moment, is whether there'll be a monetary value to other benefits outside of their link to carbon. So Gold Standard introduced a water benefit certification scheme a few years ago, so that to try to allow organizations trying to provide access to clean, safe water to monetize their benefit which they're bringing. And there was no demand at the time. And there's a question in the market right now about biodiversity. So there's a lot of interest in potential for biodiversity credit market. But again, I think there's real questions about whether demand exists for those. And that's one of the real questions which we don't really know the answer to yet, but we'll have to see.
Yeah. And do you see an increasing share of projects that organize value sharing of the credit value with the local communities, or is it still flat?
No, I mean, I think for many of our projects, this has been built in for a long time. And there's some project developers who have very standard processes for how this is done to make sure that there is the fair share is provided back. I think one of the questions that we ask ourselves as a standard is, to what extent is it our role to try to define benefit sharing, because it changes contextually between different countries, between activity types, between communities. And so that's a question that we ask, whether we should be providing more definition of this, or whether that it makes sense for this to be decided at the project level. But we're also seeing more governments introducing requirements around this. So there's been several governments in Africa in the past couple of years who require projects to provide a share of profits, a share of credit revenue back to communities. And so they are fixing at the government level what percentage should go back to local communities, and then also into different funds which are managed by the government, and other ways to make sure that benefits are shared.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Maybe another angle, because we are discussing a lot about the way project developers must include certain parameters, risk screening, needs identification, opportunities for communities to make it, let's say, more equitable, more impactful in terms of social and environmental impact. But there's also another angle, which is how public players can, step in and in a way define some rules that can channel the use of VCMs for the benefit of local communities. Adrien, we've worked on that together on, with for Asian Development Bank and in the government of India. Maybe you could share a few ideas on that.
Yeah, sure, Rafael. I think building upon what you shared is quite interesting. So I think on government side, there's quite a few clarifications that need to be made. We've seen the example of Indonesia, for example, that realized that they hadn't established the necessary regulation to make sure that projects that were being developed in Indonesia actually benefited not only those private project developers, but local communities and Indonesia as a whole. And so putting in place and clarifying VCM framework for each country, I think, is a first step. First of all, because in most countries, there's still some uncertainty between nationally determined contribution and private projects. And so some investors might be reluctant to invest in a specific location if he's not secured about the ownership of the credits that are being generated. And at the same time, some countries might be reluctant because they see those projects as taking the value out of the country and not supporting the livelihoods of the people. So as Rafael mentioned, we reflected upon those ideas working for the Asian Development Bank. And I think that's some win-win regulation clarification can be found in that if some governments, for example, provide a secure framework for investors saying that credits generated within the framework of a specific project are will not be counted towards NDC, for example, is additional security for investors. At the same time, within those same agreements, governments, and as you were mentioning, Hugh, should put more stringent conditions for project developers in establishing a minimum threshold for fair value sharing towards local communities, in the sense that project developers and projects that are being developed should have livelihood support and fair value sharing embedded from the get-go. And establishing regulations that have those principles in mind should be the first steps for host countries.
Thanks a lot, Adrien. Maybe conclusion words. I'm sorry we cannot answer to all the questions, but I see that in the chat some answers have been posted. So I hope it's okay. We are still available on contact@xapa.org. KSAPA. So if ever you have questions, we can also forward it to our speakers, Carla and Hugh. Maybe words of conclusion, Carla, Hugh, Adrien. Please, Carla.
Yeah, so along the same lines of what we've been discussing, I think ensuring integrity both at the demand and supply side is key, and that we should race to develop more the markets to match the demand that is increasing exponentially. And that it is important to integrate with other factors such as the local capacity development and benefits on the ground for the local communities. So overall, like, we see carbon markets and carbon finance in particular in our work to be very critical and as a very important tool to catalyze more climate investments and help develop more climate finance solutions.
Thanks, Carla. Adrien?
Yeah, I think that's reflecting upon what we shared today, we see also increasing maturity from investors and buyers of credits, which is encouraging in the sense that they themselves and choose to pursue higher value credits instead of simply low value credits that are set there in the case. So this increased maturity is, of course, important in paving the way for high value projects, and all actors in the ecosystem are working towards that. So despite the criticism, I think the global trend is still encouraging for ECMs.
Thank you, Adrien. Hugues, a few words, please, to conclude.
Yeah, I guess it's just to say that, so the question here is how to ensure socially and environmentally impactful voluntary carbon markets. And the answer is that no one organization is responsible for that. It needs many to act in their own way. So there is a role for governments to provide the right regulation to make sure there are safeguards in place. There's a role for standards like ours to make sure that projects follow methodologies that have environmental integrity and follow requirements which ensure social impact, inclusivity, sustainable development benefits. But there's also a role for projects to in how they implement that. You can implement very much at the surface level, or you can go deeper in terms of trying to make sure you're developing and implementing a project which really does have this impact. And then there's a role on the part of buyers in seeking those projects out and not going for the cheapest on the market, but looking for the projects which do deliver that wider impact as well. And so I think responsibility lies across many different actors, as well as the ICBCM and others, and we need to work together.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, thanks a lot to all three and to the audience too for having been quite numerous today to follow our discussions. Well, at XAPA, we will try to apply these principles and develop our own VCM projects with high social and environmental impact. Please follow us on social networks, LinkedIn, of course, XAPA, KSAPA.org, as well on our website. We will have a few other webinars to come, and you can find that in our event section on our XAPA.org webinar, especially one coming in the coming days, organized with the OECD. Thanks a lot. It was great to have this discussion, and let's continue work for social and environmental action. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.